And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm really excited that we are ending the week with a good friend to the morning show, Deborah Karp, who is currently director of the Alan E. Guskin Center for Community and Business Engagement at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, our neighbors to the north. But Deborah Karp is not on the job too much longer. Her retirement is looming in the very, very near future. And I wanted to be sure to take the opportunity to talk with Deborah Karp about the work that she has done at Parkside over the years. And actually, she has an interesting resume, as I found out last night, stretching back to even before she began her work at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside. In particular, she, of course, has worked with Parkside's many community and business partners and forged some really, really strong connections between Parkside and the surrounding communities, and also has done very, very important work with nonprofits in the area. And we'll take some time to talk about the ways in which the functioning of nonprofits has sort of ebbed and flowed, and the climate in which nonprofits are operating right now and the challenges that they face. And, well, there'll be plenty of other things to cover as well. So without further ado, Deborah Karp, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thank you. Good morning, Greg.
It's really nice to have you here, and I'm glad that we can have this conversation. What I touched on at the outset there is that when I was able to see kind of a full resume of your professional life, I wasn't prepared for just what a long list it was, not just of all you've done at Parkside, which in and of itself is formidable, but a couple of really interesting professional experiences you had even ahead of Parkside. So let's just get a little sketch of where you come from originally and what your earliest professional aspirations were.
Oh, well, I'm from New York, and I went to college in North Carolina in Chapel Hill. And so I ended up falling in love with North Carolina and graduated from college and worked at North Carolina State University doing the theater program. I mean, it was a presenting theater, and that was work I thought I was really going to be doing for the rest of my life. But, you know, I was like 23, whatever age I was. And I was like, oh, I need to do something different. And I became aware of the field of arts administration. And so that's what brought me to Wisconsin, was that I did my master's degree at the Bowles Center for Arts Administration at UW-Madison. And so then that was exciting. And that's what I thought I was going to do, that kind of work, and went back down to North Carolina because I love North Carolina. I still do. I got a job as executive director of an arts festival, citywide, big arts festival. And it was very exciting and fun work. And meantime, though, I met my husband when I was in graduate school, and Wisconsin called him back. So I went with him because, you know, that was just what we did at that time. I was pregnant, and we were ready to sort of settle down with our family, and most of his family is in this region. So we came back to Racine, and I never thought we would be here this long. I mean, honestly, we didn't even – I said, oh, I don't care what school district we move into because I don't think our kids will be – and it was like, here we are, 30 years. My daughter is almost 31 years old.
So when it comes to predictions, you're pretty rotten, it sounds like.
Yeah. Had no idea.
You do other things well besides predict the future. So, or at least predicting your own future, you're not all that competent. I think life is full of surprises for a whole lot of people, and how great that it is. I mean, when we just quietly follow the script, that something is certainly missing. I know that one of the things that you did upon moving back here was you had a position at Wisdom for a while.
Yeah, for a short time, actually, for about a year and a half, I was they didn't have a marketing director at the time at Wisdom, and so it was a part-time position. And it's funny because it was great. I mean, it involved a little bit of fun development. It was really fun to work with people like Bruce Pepich, and I did it for about a year and a half. At the same time, I had an opportunity to start teaching arts management at Parkside, which I was juggling two part-time jobs. And then I got pregnant with my third child. And at that time, it was just better for me, for my family, for me to just focus on one or the other. But the fun thing is that now I'm serving on the board of the RAM. In fact, I'm the president of the board. I just became the president in May. And so I'm able to still, you know, I've been, you know, peripherally involved with the museum since I left. And, but, you know, it's a wonderful treasure for the community.
Oh, it's incredible.
And I'm really excited about the, we have a new executive director, you probably know that. And just excited about the opportunity to look at what the next step is for the museum. I mean, clearly it's, you know, really just a well-established and, you know, sort of a venerable organization for Racine and for the whole region, if
right.
not the state.
Absolutely. So as you just said, the beginning of your work at the University of Wisconsin Parkside was with their arts management program, and it sounds like you were their coordinator.
Yeah, I taught classes. It was I taught one or two classes a semester, and you know they didn't have an arts management program. They were just sort of thinking it through. Mm. And I used to work when I was in graduate school for the Wisconsin Arts Board, and I knew actually my boss there was the director when they had the Percent for Art program. And so the Percent for Art program, they had built a Ranger Hall at UW Parkside, and whenever they built a new state building, they had a certain percentage, I think it was like 0.5, half of a half a percent, some really small amount of money, to do a public art piece that would be part of the institution. And we have several of those at Parkside. And so the director of that program knew I was living in Racine. I had moved back to Wisconsin, and she asked me to be on the committee. And so I happened to, also on the committee was Doug DeVinny, professor of art at Parkside.
Oh, yeah.
And he and I started talking, and I said, I heard you started an arts management program. And he said, yeah, you know, we did, but the person who's running that program is leaving the state. We just started it. And I had been at UW-Whitewater, where I had been teaching for 3 years doing arts management. So I made that connection, and you know, it became a thing. We developed the program, and I probably did that for maybe not quite 10 years, where I was teaching arts management classes.
Hmm. And so the timing is everything. I mean, Parkside had this need just at the time when you happened to be there and available, and so on. And actually, according to your resume, I'm looking here, it lists 1999 to 2007.
For arts management. Yeah, maybe it wasn't quite. Yeah. Yeah. Arts management is a very niche kind of program. And we always had some students, but it never grew to the degree that we had maybe hoped it might. I think we had a minor. It was an arts management minor. And we, at that point, I had had some other opportunities, and I had left to do the other things at the Center for Community Partnerships. So someone else took over arts management. And then it just really ended up being a budget cut. You know, it wasn't a program that served that many students, and you know, it's too bad, really. But they still have some strong arts management programs in like Stevens Point and UW Green Bay. I think UW Whitewater still has one.
Where you taught for a
yes,
while.
Where I taught, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So yes, there's a little bit of overlap between the years that you were doing the arts management thing at Parkside and when you begin this new venture in 2004. It lists here Director of Community-Based Scholarship and Nonprofit Development. And, of course, you're going to wear several different hats and several different exalted titles before things
exalted,
finish out for you at Parkside.
Yeah, okay.
Sure. Yeah, let's go with it.
Okay, okay.
So tell us about this particular invitation and actually what it says about Parkside then and to the present day in terms of their priorities, in terms of the school versus the outer community.
Yes, it's interesting. You know, Parkside has a really long history of partnering with the community. And there were a group of people. It was the directors of both the United Ways in Kenosha County, Racine County, the Departments of Human Development, representatives from there, the community foundations. I'm probably leaving out some people that were important, but there was a group of people who were working with the then director of continuing ed at UW Parkside, and they came up with the idea that, they realized that the nonprofits in this region, there was no sort of management support agency like there are in other communities. Like at the time, there was the Nonprofit Center in Milwaukee. Mm. And they thought that as a collaborative, as a partnership, they could pull together a program that supported nonprofit organizations in terms of building governance, management, infrastructure, you know, not programmatically, but really like looking at how can we make these organizations stronger, build their capacity. That was what it was about. And so they formed a committee, they began some planning, and they received some funding. And that's how I got involved, because they hired me to be the first director, or whatever they called me at the time, of this program. And I was a half-time position. It started out as a half-time position. And I started doing that. So I was doing arts management at the time, too, because they're both part-time jobs. Mm-hmm. And there are some overlap there, clearly, because, you know, when you're doing arts management, for me, what that meant was mostly working with nonprofit organizations. I mean, of course, there are for-profit arts organizations, but mostly the focus, especially around here, most of the organizations are nonprofit. And a lot of the principles, like things like fund development or, budget management and all those kinds of things. I mean, they're the same regardless of the type of, you know, discipline or the piece of the nonprofit sector that we're talking about. So lots of my background, my education was relevant for generic sort of nonprofit management development. So it was great.
Hmm. I remember when we would have conversations about working with nonprofits that I can remember it being said that a lot of the people who enter the nonprofit sector do so for really laudable reasons, because often it is driven by very deeply held, sincere passions for a given concern.
Absolutely.
But that does not necessarily equal all of the other stuff that is involved in the day-to-day reality of keeping a nonprofit afloat, let alone, you know, ushering it into a sort of a thriving sense of well-being. So I should think that's been an interesting challenge over the years in terms of injecting the practical into what otherwise often feels like an adventure that isn't about the practical. It's about things that are a lot more important than that. And yet you're there, among other things, to make sure that these other pieces are attended to.
Yeah. You know, I've seen increasing professionalism in the arts as well as in other aspects, certainly in the nonprofit sector, and more opportunities for people who are in leadership roles in these organizations to be trained professionally. More and more people come out with, you know, masters in nonprofit or public administration. And so I do think that over the years, there's been recognition, greater recognition, that we need this kind of support, and that, you know, the passion for the mission is not enough to be able to sustain an organization. And so, I do think, and around here, I think that was what we were trying to do. We were trying to provide professional development for staff and, you know, nonprofit executive directors, but other staff, to be able to give them the skills so that they could realize the mission of their organization. Because, passion is important, but not enough.
Right. It in and of itself does not get the bills paid and the deadlines met and other things. So over the years, you helped coordinate some of these really interesting events in which all kinds of notable people, sometimes from around the country, mm-hmm. would come to offer their expertise. Describe what those experiences in general were like. I mean, in the kind of progress that you think was made in terms of a lot of nonprofits in the area.
Well, I would say that in 2006, which was shortly after we started the Nonprofit Institute, was what we called it at that time, we did our first nonprofit leadership conference. We didn't call it that. I think we called it a board development conference. Hmm. And we did quite a lot of board development work at that time.
Where boards of directors would yeah. understand their mission better.
Yes, and, because that was that's a whole piece. That's the governance piece. That's another piece. It's not just about the staff understanding what their roles need to be and the skill sets that they need and the and how to do their jobs well, but it's the board members understanding who, like, what is their role. And how do they live that out to make the organizations more effective? And so that was our first conference. And, you know, there are different pieces to it. A conference doesn't have a lot of depth, really. I think it serves, first of all, to inspire people. So we'd bring in people who have, you know, exciting stories, inspirational kinds of messages, even just for people to feel good about working in the sector. Because as you mentioned, people work more often in the nonprofit sector because they care about the mission. It's not about the money. Right. So you got to feel good about what you're doing, right? So there's that piece to it. And then there were tips and tools. We would do breakout sessions. But, you know, it's not in depth. It's an hour and a half session. But it gives people access to resources. But I think the most important thing that was starting to happen when we started doing those conferences was that the networking, the bringing people together and for them to make connections with one another. And other things grew out of the conferences. So that was a big start. I think for us, one of the key things that happened was back in end of 2007, we received these enormous federal grants. We got two grants, one in end of 2007 from the federal government. It was for nonprofit capacity building. It's called the Compassion Capital Demonstration Fund. And we got $1 million. And the first $1 million, we had to spend, I can't remember now the percentage, but we had a huge amount of money that we had to subaward to nonprofit organizations for capacity building efforts. And so I think that's what really put Parkside on the map in terms of supporting nonprofits. Because the truth is that, like, all this other stuff, that people appreciate that, no question. But when you have money to give away, they pay attention, right?
Right.
And so that really began to really solidify our relationships. And of course, our other partners were really involved. They helped us to structure a program to be able to give away money, because believe it or not, it seems like, oh, what an amazing, fun thing to do is to give out money. But in fact, especially because it was federal money and everything had to be really well documented, and we had to have an equitable process and all the rest of this. I mean, because of that, it was a huge endeavor. And we hired a lot of staff. We had money to hire staff to help manage that program. And so that was really, I think, a pivotal point, because that grant was for 3 years. And then 2 years into that grant, the administration changed and a new program came in, but it was basically the same idea. And we got another $1.5 million. And so we had, over a four-year period of time, we had about half of that. I think about half of $2.5 million was given away to community organizations for capacity building. And so there was the money to do things like for a food bank to buy a refrigerator, or it could be to hire somebody to help you with your strategic plan. But we were also doing other stuff. We were providing free training. So the conferences, we did a lot more training at that time for nonprofits because we had the resources to do that. And, you know, we built a nonprofit leadership certificate program. Eventually, later, we also did a fund development certificate program. So we were building sort of our capacity to deliver this kind of training. But the boost that we got from the federal funding was really huge. And it made a difference for a lot of organizations like RVM and Racine, I can think of. I mean, we worked with probably 90 different nonprofits at that time. I think of RVM because they were really a fledgling organization at that time.
And, Racine Vocational Ministries.
That's right. Yeah. Yes, that's right. With Jim Schatzman, he was just really literally founding that organization when we had that funding. And so we were able to give them, I can't remember specifically, but they were very engaged in the project. And I think, you know, it's not, I think they would have made it, but I think it really helped them move along a lot more quickly.
Right.
And many organizations. And so, but what it did for us also at Parkside was we were able to build these relationships with the nonprofit community in a really much deeper way. Also gave us opportunities for our students to connect with community-based learning. And so that was another way we could help build capacity in nonprofits. And so we were able to sort of integrate the resources we had from the campus, and then that allowed us also to be able to do to sustain some of it beyond the life of the grants.
Right. Yeah. Well, and it's interesting when you use terminology like building capacity in a nonprofit, which is all well and good, but then you start thinking about, for instance, just to pick one, Racine Vocational Ministries, and you think about the people that organization has helped over the years. I mean, people just out of the penitentiary trying to rebuild their lives, and the enormous difference that just that one single organization has made in how many lives over the years. And I can't imagine what it must feel like for you to know that you and Parkside have played a part in that by helping to really, for instance, launch that nonprofit and many, many others. I mean, not solely launching it, but I mean, really helping them achieve flight, I guess is what I'm saying. I mean, that has to make you feel so good.
Yeah, I don't want to take credit. I mean, the work that they've done is amazing.
Of course.
But I'm glad that we could be a part of it and help get them, move them along, maybe move them along a little more quickly. Yeah, absolutely. And it is a good thing. I mean, I love that. I love that we have been able to really help nonprofit, and we continue to do that. I mean, I don't want to make it sound like that was like the heyday, and you know, I think the work that we're still doing at Parkside and our partnership with many organizations in the community still is helping to support the nonprofit sector.
Right.
Yeah.
And I guess all I'm saying is you're helping these nonprofits who are helping all these people.
Yeah.
So it's like, you know, you are in a sense one step removed, but still a vital, vital part of the great work that they do, the life-changing work that they do. For those of you just joining us, we're speaking today on the morning show with Deborah Karp, and she is about to retire from the University of Wisconsin-Parkside after many, many years there. Currently, her position is director of the Alan E. Guskin Center for Community and Business Engagement. And I want to make sure we don't go any further without giving you a chance to explain to our listeners who Alan E. Guskin was. I was actually sort of joking about asking you to give us his biography, thinking you wouldn't be able to. And it turns out it's a great story that our listeners should really hear.
Well, Alan E. Guskin is actually still alive. And he was the second chancellor of the university. And the first chancellor was only there for a short period of time. So sort of getting the buildings ready in the late 1960s. Alan E. Guskin was at the university for about 10 years, and he had a passion for civic and community engagement. Mm. And so he built the foundation for the work that we're doing now, and for the sort of like the commitment to community engagement that UW Parkside still continues. But the fun story about Alan E. Guskin is, and I didn't learn this until 2019 when we had our 50th anniversary and we renamed our center for Alan E. Guskin. And so what we found out was when he was in college back in, I don't know exactly, but he's in his mid-80s now. He was in college at the University of Michigan. And he and a group of other students came up with an idea for like an international program. And they had some opportunity to present this program to President Kennedy. And President Kennedy was completely enthralled by the idea, and that was the seed that built the Peace Corps. And Al Guskin was one of the first students, young people, to go out in that very first cohort of Peace Corps volunteers. He said he was in Thailand. And so, you know, his spirit of engagement and helping people really started at a young age. So, we can thank Al Guskin and some of his fellow students at University of Michigan for inspiring the idea behind the Peace Corps. So that was kind of a cool thing to learn about him. Yeah, yeah, it was really cool. And and UW Parkside, we do... I don't know how many students we have who actually go into the Peace Corps. For a while, we bring the Peace Corps, the Peace Corps volunteers, coordinators to campus to tell students about the opportunities. We've been more involved with what became the domestic Peace Corps, AmeriCorps.
Right.
And that was established by President Clinton later, I think, in the 90s.
Yeah. I'm so glad to know that. I mean, it is so easy to kind of brush past a name that adorns a program or a building or whatever, and quite often that name is there for a very good reason. And of course, in this case, what you're really telling us is this amazing legacy that UW Parkside has for being connected to the community, perhaps to large measure, is because of this chancellor, Alan E. Guskin, and his own passion for that.
Yeah, yeah. He worked very closely with Esther Letvin, and Esther also had the passion. And so we have also some Esther. She was the one who formed the Center for Community Partnerships at UW Parkside back in the early 2000s or late 1990s. And so, yeah, I mean, for sure, there have been people like, I guess, you know, I mean, whose shoulders I stand on kind of thing, whose philosophy and commitment to civic and community engagement is really foundational for this community, for UW Parkside's identity.
Right. Love that. I'm reminded, by the way, a quick tangent. When they opened the Rita, I was brought in to be the MC for the big ceremony that dedicated it. And I was so honored to be asked to do that. And it was only like seconds before I was supposed to welcome everybody that the thought occurred to me. And so even though I don't think I was supposed to deviate from the script, I did briefly to say, you know, it feels really, in some ways, it feels really strange for me to be here. I mean, I have a Parkside library card, and otherwise I have no official connection to Parkside at all. I know many people there. I've done all these interviews, but I'm not part of UW Parkside. And there's all kinds of people here who should be standing here who could do this just as well as I am. But how fitting that somebody not officially associated with Parkside is standing here, because Parkside, for as long as I've been here, has been so much about that, about not just its own faculty and staff and students, but also the outside community, caring about them, connecting with them. And so in that respect, it made all the sense in the world, not necessarily for me, but for somebody from the outer community to be front and center on a big occasion like that.
And right. And somebody like you who's really recognized themselves in the arts. I mean, that was what it was about.
Sure,
was
that about, makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, yeah.
But I mean, but the fact that, and again, I just want to bring it back to this amazing legacy that Parkside has of connecting with the community in a way that does not always happen. I mean, obviously, all colleges and universities try to do that and need to do that, but it just seems like Parkside is a sterling success story when it comes to that. The AmeriCorps piece, I think it would be interesting to have you just talk a little bit about the involvement that you have had with that. And, of course, that is an interesting story in and of itself.
Yeah. Well, I think we got our very first AmeriCorps Vista member in 2004, within months of me starting my job as a nonprofit. And we, at the time, we were part of an national organization called Campus Compact, and the statewide organization had an AmeriCorps Vista program. Vista is a specific piece of AmeriCorps, and what it really is about is building capacity in nonprofit organizations. So it was a good fit for us, and so we had our very first Vista, who later became the director of United Way in Kenosha County for a short time.
Wow!
So we became involved at that time, and for several years we had Vistas who we brought either on campus to help build capacity with our connections to community, or who were part-time placed out in nonprofit organizations in the community. And then in about 2012, we started our own Vista. We became an intermediary, which means that we hosted a group of Vistas, and we did all the intermediary management of that program. And so for that lasted until about 2017, I think. And there were just issues with the way. It doesn't matter. It just fell by the wayside.
Sure.
I don't want to say fell by the wayside. We made a conscious choice not to continue the program, although I do sincerely believe that it is a wonderful program, not only for the organizations that receive the benefit of the Vistas, But in fact, for the Vistas themselves, it is a huge professional development, leadership development, community awareness program. The people, as I mentioned when I referred to earlier about the Vista who went on to become director of United Way, another of our past Vistas is, I don't remember her title, but she's very involved with Racine Kenosha Community Action Agency. She has a leadership role there now. Any number of our Vistas have gone on to do really amazing things, both in this community and other communities across the country. And I know this is true of Vista across the country, yeah.
Right. It'll be interesting to see where that program goes in these challenging times. But it's good to hear the success stories that you have yourself seen. You made passing reference to something that I know we should talk a bit about, and that is this whole notion of community-based learning. This is something that, of course, has often fallen under your auspices at Parkside. So first of all, even before you got to Parkside, was this something that was quite important, or is this a more recent development?
No, actually, it was there before I got there. In fact, part of the Center for Community Partnerships was the Institute for Community-Based Learning, and it was founded by a sociology professor, Ann Statham. And Esther Leffen, a few people, got a federal grant in the late 1990s, and it was from the Housing and Urban Development, and it was about universities and communities. And as part of that, what Ann did was sort of do a survey of our campus to find out who was doing community-based learning.
Because like already.
Yeah, people, you know, it's a teaching methodology, right? And so, you know, it's a pedagogy, right? Some of our professors were already and heavily involved in the community. And again, you know, philosophically, Parkside was really open to this idea, but we didn't have any kind of documentation and to know who was doing what. And so Anne pulled together that information. That's how I got involved, because I was doing community-based learning in my arts management classes.
Ah.
I learned from when I was in graduate school that this was a good way for students to learn, was to engage with real-life kinds of situations and with real partners who were really out in the field.
Just learn about them theoretically in a classroom, but then get out in the world.
Right, and apply. The nonprofit community in this region is so amazing in that they really understand how important this is for our students, and we see them as co-educators. So even though, you know, the hope is, of course, that the nonprofit organizations benefit from, you know, whatever the project is, a new database or a whole new, I don't know, some kind of a new system for what am I thinking? Anyway, it doesn't matter. The point is that the nonprofits in the community benefit from those things, but our students benefit just as much. And so many of our partners are so willing to give of their time to help our students understand what's going on, so the students can do a better job on the project. But you know, it's that whole thing about, like, you learn from doing, and then you learn from reflecting on the doing, and that's the philosophy of community-based learning as a pedagogy. And so we have about 1,000 students every year who engage in community-based learning, I'm not as close to this as I was before. Amy Garrigan runs this program now.
Oh, yeah.
But I would say probably 50 or 60 partnerships that we have going on each year with connecting with our courses. We have some partnerships we have are really long-standing, and those are amazing. Those types of relationships, when faculty build relationships with partners and they can do an ongoing partnership, those are the most beneficial, both for our students and, of course, for the community. But our community has really stepped up as really, really strong co-educators.
Right. I think you've touched on something that I think a lot of people don't understand. I certainly didn't understand this for a while. And that is, I think when sometimes people hear this community-based learning, they're still thinking about students in a relatively passive position. I mean, not in a classroom, sitting at a desk, taking in information, but maybe going out in the community and meeting with people, but, in a sense, theoretically, sitting at a desk and taking down information. And what you are describing, of course, is something that is far more dynamic, in which that student is out in the community to contribute, I mean, to create something that will be a very direct benefit to, for instance, a given nonprofit or a company or whatever, but actually more in the driver's seat than in the desk seat. And that is part of what makes it even more exciting.
Yeah, and I think there are different levels of community-based learning. Students who are in lower-level courses, it's more like a volunteer experience. So, for example, they might go to the Shalom Center food pantry and help with, you know, selecting food or packing boxes or doing those types of experiences, or going out and picking garlic mustard at, you know, for an environmental organization. Whereas at higher levels, when students have the skills, they're doing things like, for example, recently, there was actually a show on WGTD about this, but United Way of Kenosha County worked with a GIS class, GIS and communities.
For mapping.
And they created a map of the resources that people could use on the website. They could look it up on their phones. And this was a huge benefit to the United Way and its partner agencies or partner providers to be able to have this resource to share with clients of their organizations. And so that's a much more sophisticated project. Many of these projects, students work in teams. And so there's so many benefits to these experiences, because they're getting the experience of working with diverse teams. They're getting the experience of working with a community partner or a client of sorts. We have another really exciting project that's been going on for years with ArtRoute and Racine. Carrie Waters, a professor of design at UW Parkside, her students have been designing what they call the wall poems. So we have now 7 or 8 murals that are installed in Racine that we've been working on over the last 5-7 years, maybe even longer. And so, you know, that's about, the students learn about the importance of, you know, brightening a community, enlivening a community with art. They learn about how to design a piece for a specific, a site-specific mural piece. They learn about a little bit, in this case, since they're wall poems, they learn a little about poetry and the poetic process. I mean, so it's really a wonderful experience for our students, but, you know, here it is. We have images now in Racine in areas that add pride, you know, give people more pride in their neighborhoods and so on, that kind of thing.
Yeah, so exciting. What would typically be your role, you and your staff, in terms of contributing to this?
Okay, yeah. Well, Amy is the matchmaker. Right. At some point, I was the matchmaker before Amy came and before a long time ago. But now, the last 8 years, I think she's been there, Amy has taken on that role. I sometimes participate. I mean, if any of us hear of an opportunity, we're bringing it back to our team.
Right. And I was really curious about that, the nature of that matchmaking.
Yeah. Well, and it, you know, it comes from so many different things. We do our nonprofit breakfast once a year, and we bring in the nonprofits to basically do some interaction with our faculty to see if they can connect to some of the classes that they're doing. Amy, people know to call us too, so, you know, those connections can be made at the breakfast sort of randomly. Otherwise, you know, many of our faculty serve on nonprofit boards. They're involved out in the community. So if they become aware of a need, maybe they come in back and they talk to Amy and say, hey, this organization is looking for XYZ. Is that something we can do? And we also, Amy still does it, but for about 7 years, I was the co-facilitator for Leadership Kenosha. And Leadership Kenosha also does very similar kinds of projects, a little bit longer term, with professionals, not students, who are doing projects for nonprofits. So, you know, because it was really good synergy for us to be doing this, because sometimes we see a project, it's a really good fit for Leadership Kenosha. Other times, it's a really good fit for a college class. So, I mean, people often come to us, I think, more than I don't know. And sometimes we just make connections. I mean, the Wall Poems Project came out of I was serving on the board of ArtRoot, and I became aware of the need for this and connected them with this professor who's been doing the work for years now. So each one has got, you know, a different story.
Sure. Well, and it's helpful when, for instance, somebody like you is out in the community yourself, just as a member of the community, and of course faculty as well. I mean,
yes.
If you were all just in your lovely isolated UW Parkside silo, in splendid isolation, this would all be kind of nebulous and theoretical, and it's not. It's actually, you yourself have been in the trenches. You and other colleagues authentically care about these organizations and the work that they're doing, even beyond the potential benefit for Parkside students. It seems to me that that's essential to making all of this work so well.
Right. Yeah. No, I think that's really true. And it's really, really not just about our little team in the Guskin Center. It is about all of our faculty and staff who are, you know, serving on, be involved in nonprofits. I can think of five examples where people who serve on a nonprofit board is someone who's a professor who brings their class or brings another class in to connect with that project. The Women's Resource Center in Racine, Dr. Penny Leiter, when she was at Parkside, she was very involved. She had her students in her classes involved, and then she brought another professor whose students got involved. And so I do think that it definitely is, you know, it's a networking thing. It's connections, and that's what's really important, and that's what a community is, right?
Of course.
You know, so it's perfect.
Absolutely. And even though we bandy the term connections around a lot, it's nothing to underestimate in terms of its significance for all of us. Really true. As I read through this long resume of just the various things you've done at Parkside, it was also really, it's also the story of change, of alteration, of the central mission being transformed at certain points. I'm just kind of curious what it's been like to be at Parkside over the course of all these years when various sort of reorganization frameworks have, you know, come and gone or changed and so on. I mean, I'm sure a lot of what you've done, what you've actually done, is not dramatically changed, and yet I'm sure there have been ways in which the way you delivered what you did and so on, that probably did change a bit.
Yeah, I think there's been a change in structure. And, you know, there's a lot of factors that go into those kinds of things. Like right now, we are in a big, big change for the university. What affects my department most is that we now have a new, we're calling it the Partnership Hub. And we brought in a new person as the executive director of this Partnership Hub. And it's going to have a focus on some of the very same things that we've talked about today, but in addition, really a greater emphasis on workforce development and meeting the needs of employers in the region. And we have done that work. We've been doing that work for years, but in a more focused way and pulling us back together. For a long time, we had what was called the Center for Community Partnerships, and we pulled together all the units that did any kind of outreach, and that was successful for quite some time. And then things started shifting around, and we moved things like the Small Business Development Center out of the CCP into the Department of Business, and we moved the Professional Development for Teachers program into the Teacher Education program.
So, like, and decentralization.
It was decentralized. Yeah. It absolutely was decentralized. And in a lot of ways, you know, people could argue that then it was more pervasive, right? We also found that over time you lose touch with, like, okay, if this department is working with this organization and that department over there is also working with that organization, but they don't know that. So I think this is an effort to pull together information so that we can benefit from the sort of the synergies of these partnerships and to be aware of all of the ways that we partner with an individual business or nonprofit organization or government agency, and also to really harness our resources and focus on how we can best help this community in terms of economic development, workforce development. You know, certainly we are not going to be neglecting the nonprofit sector, but it's a big change in structure for us. I've been through the changes enough times, as I'm about to retire, that I think okay, like, let's go, let's do it. I'm not going to be involved in that process, but I have complete confidence in all the people that are involved. My team is an amazing group of people, and the vision, I think, for it is really strong. So, yay, you know, I think it's going to be a good thing.
That's very, very good. So you will be cheering from the sidelines.
Yes, yeah. Yeah.
Now, will the sidelines be in North Carolina, or are you planning on staying close to this region for
a while?
You know,
it's funny because my husband is not about to retire yet, and we talked about actually buying a house in North Carolina, but right now, like, our children are sort of focused here, and you know, we'll see. I don't know. I'm hoping to do a lot of travel and spend more time in New York with my parents, who are still doing okay, but almost 90 years old, right?
Wow.
So it's you know, I don't know. I don't know where exactly we're going to land, but we're going to be here for at least, I'd say, at least 5 years, maybe the rest of my life. I don't know.
Of course, but be careful. As we started this conversation, yeah, we talked about how you don't always predict your own future.
Yes, right. I'm not good at that. Yeah,
yes. Right. Yeah. Like, time will tell. Well, this corridor between Milwaukee and Chicago is such a vibrant, exciting place to be. And, of course, one of the reasons is Gateway and Carthage and the University of Wisconsin Parkside and all that they have created over the years. And I want to say it's been such a pleasure and privilege to talk with you repeatedly over the years about all of the important things that you have been doing at UW Parkside. And we don't always bring someone on when they're about to retire from even really important positions, but this just felt right to look back at all of the various things that you and, of course, your whole team have done at Parkside. And I applaud you for all of that, and thank you for all of the times you've come on the morning show to tell this great story. And we wish you well in retirement, whatever that looks like for you.
Thank you very much.
Deborah Karp, the outgoing director of the Allen E. Guskin Center for Community and Business Engagement at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside. This weekend, on the podcast version of the morning show, we're going to celebrate what would have been the 100th birthday of great singer Bill Hayes, who for many years was probably most famous as a member of the cast of the NBC soap opera Days of Our Lives, but also a wonderful singer, and had a long and varied career that included Broadway and being on Sid Caesar's Your Show of Shows and so on. I was privileged to record a lengthy interview with Bill Hayes several years ago, and I'm going to be sharing that on the podcast version of the morning show this weekend. If you subscribe to the morning show podcast, you can hear a different morning show 7 days a week with archival interviews featured on Saturday and Sunday. Be sure to look for the morning show with Greg Berg. It's available wherever you get your podcasts. Today is going to be a partly cloudy day with an air quality alert in effect until noon. We are headed for a high of 72 degrees. Overnight low of 51. Tomorrow's high, 68 under sunny skies. It does look like we will have a pretty good chance of rain on Sunday with a high of 73. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva.